Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
In a very banal way, I would like to start with the name of our office, the Office for Metropolitan Architecture. It is a very important fact that this is an office which did not originate from a building, but it actually originated from a book. A book in 1978, written by Rem Koolhaas, published at a date when I was 14 years old. And I think in relation to freedom, this immediately constitutes a kind of an important fact. It means that the office was developed in the space of writing, which I guess invariably is the space of thinking, which always has a degree of freedom, no matter what kind of messy circumstances you get involved in. And it's a freedom, of course, we relish in parallel to the buildings we do. I think also the interesting thing is, and I'm partially speaking for myself here, but I know it goes to a large extent for others too, is the fact that your office is based on a book which is essentially not written by me or anybody else, but by another person, also, paradoxically as it may sound, constitutes a degree of freedom, because in a strange way, because it isn't a style, an architectural style, but, you know, a body of thought, it is also a body of thought that can be inhabited by others and expanded by others. It is something that you can become part of, even if as an architect, stylistically, you may want to do different things. So in that sense, it's a source of cohesion, but always a source of freedom. This is an image from the book. It's actually an earlier project, which has made its way into the book as its fictional conclusion. It's the City of the Captive Globe. And I think the book is interesting precisely for that reason, in the sense that I think it's the first book of the 20th century that is actually realistic about the value or the relevance of architecture. What you see here is, in a way, a series of buildings, which in a way are all in their own way part of totalizing architectural theories, which all assume that once they were designed, everything after them will be designed like them. They all claim a validity well beyond their own borders. And in a way, here in the context of the Manhattan grid, they are all reduced to kind of reproductions of the worlds in their own right, with a strong ideology, but nevertheless an ideology that is confined to the walls of the buildings. And of course, a drawing like this, in a way, heralds a truly agnostic Asian architecture, partially as a reaction to a lot of stuff that has happened since. It's an important image that will become clear later. Of course, we meanwhile do the buildings that were once described in the book. Another freedom of globalization is the fact that you can do buildings outside their place of origin. So this is not New York, but this is in Rotterdam, a building appropriately called the Rotterdam. I'd like to talk about freedom in a more general sense. Much has been talked about freedom. Ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall, we assume that for the first time we live in a world that is fully free, and that freedom has been theorized abundantly by people like Fukuyama, and that freedom has been made absolute as an ideology, like in a way Fukuyama's End of History, the assumption that Western liberal democracy would be the one and only remaining system in the world, a kind of end of ideologies and a collective embrace of economic values. If this was the world before 1991, a world of parallel systems, Western, communist, and non-aligned, then this was the presumed world after 1991, simply a spreading of Western liberal democracy as the only system in the whole world. In a way, it was assumed that if you take the main currencies of the world already at that moment, people say yes, before it was ever openly formulated as a proposition. I guess you could say that our office in parts, and particularly the expansion of our office to its current size, is also a product of that thinking. Before 1991, we had one office in New York. After 1991, we gradually grew to six offices in the whole world. Also, I guess, in part, assuming that we would encounter similar conditions elsewhere, and that we can simply extend the domain in which we operate. We meanwhile, I think, do some 100 concurrent projects in more than 50 countries, but that's seemingly relatively uninteresting corporate speak. What is a more interesting fact is that that expansion is in a way mirrored in the composition of our office, where we have over 45 nationalities on a staff of 300, where even in the Netherlands or in Hong Kong or wherever we are, the locals are a minority. And in fact, there is no minority. The composition of our office anywhere is a sort of united colors of whatever, but it isn't that multiculturalism in itself that is interesting. What is interesting is that that multiculturalism is in a way at the root of the creative formula of our office, which I guess you can at best describe as a permanent cultural clash in which there are very few a priori. I mean, there is no majority, therefore it's an ecology of minorities with a huge amount of interrogation of each and every proposition, with a huge amount of doubt. I think this is a design session on CCTV. The man you see here is the founder of our office, who looks overcome by the most acute state of doubt, I guess, forever. But it's a long, often tiresome, wrought process with occasionally a result. And what is interesting as well is that at the time, the fact that one assumed homogeneous conditions is also evident from the choices that one made. Our largest building today is CCTV, that came into the office as part of a competition in 2002, at the same time as we were invited to work on the reconstruction of Ground Zero. We didn't opt for this because we suspected it would become a talk show of decades. China had the Olympics, was fresh, and anyway, we opted to work in China. Clearly not without risk. Clearly that meant embedding ourselves in, well, a political system as, again, we all know it. Clearly there would be differences, but how different were these differences at the time? There is, in an interesting way, objects in your rearview mirror are closer than they appear. You know, the degree of dictatorship in China can be exaggerated. The degree of democracy in other parts of the world can be exaggerated in parallel. So there is, at the time, it looked like a wonderful symmetry. I'd like to, in a way, elaborate on that proposition. 15 years before, in front of the Berlin Wall, Reagan held a speech as a visitor to Germany with the famous line, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And much to everyone's surprise, and I think most of all Ronald Reagan's surprise, Gorbachev actually did tear down that wall. And in a way, the world as we know it today began. Since the West has won this battle, since conservative ideologists of the West can largely claim that battle, there has been a huge amount of forgetting of the other side, which I think is increasingly biting the world in the back. This is how they saw it from the other side. This is the year before. It's a celebration in former East Germany. For who speaks German, it says here, 25 years of anti-fascist protection war. So I guess it's a matter of opinion in parts. And we think that this is over. But actually, is it over? It's a beautiful Faulkner quote. The past is never dead. In fact, it isn't even past. And interestingly enough, so if it's in the 90s and the early zeros, we thought this would be the world in which we operate. We currently find the same amount of projects actually in this world, a world that isn't united in an embrace of Western liberal democracy, and a world that increasingly looks less likely like it's going to be divided. I'll give a very quick explanation. Blue is democracy. There you have election. Red is non-democracy. There you don't have election. And yellow is pseudo-democracy. There you have elections, but you know the outcome in advance. An increasingly successful political system. And I'm saying this without any value judgment. I don't want to, in a way, idealize the American or the European democracy. It's simply the different status and predictability of elections that's at play here. But a pseudo-democracy gives a very interesting propositions of dictatorships to dictatorships that no longer want to appear like dictatorships, hence can seem democratic without really becoming it. But it also clearly forms a luring proposition to established democracies to decline in lesser form of democracies with having the appropriate excuse. So It's a tricky system. So it basically means that with our expansion of the 90s, we have found ourselves in three distinctly different conditions. And I'd like to show a project, in a way, in each of these conditions. The first one is in the glorious Republic of Kazakhstan. A former Soviet republic with all the overhauls of the former Soviet Union, bad, but also good, large social housing, prefabricated social housing projects, which in parts actually still form an inspiration to our architecture. But of course, more recently, they have discovered the riches of oil. This is in the center of Almaty. It's a nightclub, appropriately called Petroleum. The image kind of speaks for itself. It's very clear which part of Western culture these countries encounter first. Of course, as with any country that becomes rich, they develop a spontaneous passion for very good architecture. I don't know who this is. Of course, knowing that, we wouldn't be we if we wouldn't spontaneously develop a passion for the architecture they had just left behind. An early constructivist diagram, which in a way formed the inspiration of stuff that we did. We were asked to design a science and technology campus, of course, owned by one of the major oil corporations in there. And this was our proposition, a science city in the middle of the snow, near the mountains, near Almaty, the Chinese border runs behind. And this is what we did. We were happy, but the whole proposition encountered rather mixed feelings. These were our clients. This was the communication with our clients. This is an excerpt from the communication with one of our project leaders. Tomorrow, we need to present the options to our bosses. We cannot just say Omar told us it's better. We need to prove it with arguments. I personally don't want to stand for it. Nice to have after discussion. Sort of some mild resistance here. Time, that generally means no, but as an architect, the same. Next email. Richard, project leader, I've got marked copies which you gave me proving the evidence of agreement. It is strange to see your resistance. I will report the issue to Yermek. This is sort of 1 o'clock in the morning, knock on the door. Then invariably call us compliance. So anyway, the contractor was already in place. There would be no tender. The contractor had excellent credentials. He had built the President Palace of Nazarbayev, and he had already been chosen actually before we arrived. The contractor was the Mabatex group, actually run by a person which on closer inspection we found was a fugitive for the Yugoslavia tribunal. A fugitive from the former Yugoslavia wanted for arms smuggling, illegal arms smuggling, and made a fortune and restarted all over again. All of this didn't end well. I don't know why, but all I know is that after a while, we got a request to submit drawings and another polite request to encounter early payment, provided we promised we wouldn't show up at the presentation. So that was that. That is, in a way, a short-lived adventure in a region where I say we probably wouldn't return, but nothing is as categorical as that. We got another chance in Russia itself, the home of the science city, or the so-called Naukograd. In 2009, the Kremlin, together with a rich oligarch, Viktor Vexelberg, launched a plan for a state-induced Silicon Valley. It's a bit of a contradiction in terms. Nevertheless, that was the case here. A Silicon Valley by imposition of the Kremlin, a competition which we did, where similar ideas, like in the previous master plan, were actually introduced in a more refined way. But for a long time, it actually looked like our chances were excellent for a number of reasons. Where we, in a way, elaborated the center of the whole thing, programmed it, presented it. Actually, we managed to get to the very top of the leadership, presented it to the Russian president. But then something mysterious happened. A not very well-known French state firm basically the odds turned and their chances of winning dramatically increased, allegedly as collateral for a deal. This was in the Russian-French friendship year, and allegedly as collateral for a deal about the Moscow-St. Petersburg highway, which was not going to be built with a French contractor, where they majorly lost that through some kind of deal. Essentially, a winner was introduced, which was French, which was announced in Paris. So it's a project, I think, currently on the whole on hold, because, as you know, the leadership of Russia changed. So it's in a way, are we happy or sad? I don't know. It's definitely not a reason never to work in Russia again. So not everything is what it seems. That's that. Then another part of the world. It is a painful irony or a painful, difficult situation. As an architect, you tend to build where there's a lot of building going on. Now, the vast majority of the building in the world is going on in places where cities grow fast. And where cities grow fast is mostly in the red and yellow, which almost by definition forges an encounter with political systems that most of us did not grow up in, but with which we somehow have to come to terms. We've done a lot of work. Well, we haven't done a lot of work, but we've spent a lot of time in Dubai. Just to give a little background, this was Dubai in 1990. This is that same city, that same road here, as you see in the previous picture, currently looks like this. That means that nothing in this picture is older than 25 years. That means, whatever you think of this, that in less than 25 years, a pretty vibrant, globally competing metropolis has almost been built from scratch. Of course, architecture in a place like that gets ever more extravagant. Every building fair is the announcement of the next Dubai. And of course, very interestingly, a kind of bastard architecture is emerging. This is Santiago Calatrava with his turning torso in Malmo. This is the Dubai equivalent of it. Probably cheaper, probably faster, probably with less hassle, and not that different. And anyway, this is the sum total of those types of architecture. This is a collage we made after visiting one of the cityscape real exchange fairs. This is basically the masterpieces by all the people nobody's ever heard of who are massively active in those regions. Now, if you look at this image, these are the masterpieces by people everyone has heard of. And, of course, it begs the question, is there really such a difference? And if there is a difference, is the difference worth the hassle? It's very interesting, if you look at this picture, you know, where every building tries to be an icon for that very reason. Nothing is an icon. It's an interesting full circle that, in a way, the condition that I showed earlier in delirious New York kind of manifests itself on steroids in the context of Dubai. This is ours, but you actually have to circle it with a red line to be able to notice it. And this building was a huge effort. And, of course, when we got involved in the context of the crisis in Dubai, which slowly meant that all of this stuff was put on hold. At the time, we thought that, in a way, the crisis, which seemed to spell the end of the iconic, or at least seemed to be an introduction to a different kind of architecture, could, in a way, lead to a rebirth. So this was our discovery in the context of Dubai. A building, a very interesting formalist adventure. Massive presence from one side, massive slenderness from another, only to reveal massive presence from the other. That's the degree of formal extravagance that we permitted here. But nevertheless, a building that, in its context, there was a facade with kind of pockets of resistance, I guess, against the totally boring. But nevertheless, a building that, in its context, despite its simplicity, despite its relatively boring appearance, could stand out. Because as said, when everything is an icon, the only building that stands out is the one that foregoes any attempt at trying to be an icon. So when we had discovered this, we were very happy. We sort of spontaneously started on a branding campaign for Dubai. This is a stamp with our building. This is an advertisement in a Korean newspaper where the building poses as a kind of new form of script. Largely a kind of a new direction, also a new direction in our office with a renewed invention of the charm of the 90-degree angle, etc., etc., and in a way a new fetish of the generic. Now, we didn't win this award. I don't think anything is being built to date, but it was a very important milestone in the production of our office. This is 2006, I believe. Then there was a long time nothing, a long time very little in the Middle East, until I encountered our building somewhere else in the middle of Beirut. And this leads to another kind of insight. This is the Holiday in Beirut in Lebanon, a building that was ravaged during the Lebanese civil war, a building that is an icon in the city, largely because of its story, where every room was fought over between the Falangist and the Palestinian Liberation Army, a Palestinian fighter in the building in front of a poster of Nasser. And a building that just stands there. I think there have been countless attempts to redevelop the building, to give it a new purpose. For some reason, nothing has worked, and it just stands there in the middle of the city, like an enormous icon, like a testimony to a past that seems over, but of course is never really over. And while it contains about 100,000 square meters, other buildings of a similar size are going up there as well. This is across the road from that building, Herzog and de Meuron. So this is modern, and this is modern. But nevertheless, there is a strange difference between the two, and there's a strange difference between modernism, I think, in the 21st century and in the 20th century, that even though stylistically there are many, many similarities, even though some of the verbal ideology that comes with these buildings is sometimes suspiciously like the 20th century, actually the system in which that architecture functions is completely different. The Beirut terraces, a world-class icon in the Middle East, etc., etc. But also, more than architecture, it is primarily real estate. It's a real estate venture, and buildings like it drive up massively the price in the center of Beirut, where largely the center is becoming unaffordable for a lot of regular Lebanese, somehow an exacerbated version of a development that's happening inside London as well. But of course, in the context of a hugely explosive religious and ethnic mix, you can really, really wonder whether gentrification is a true and honest answer to some of the problems. The terraces, of course, part of an internationally prolific style, a similar kind of thing of Herzog & de Meuron in New York, another building in Beijing, but very much part of an international style that now engulfs the major capitals of the cities. And because of what it's part of, because of what it helps doing, it is, of course, only a matter of time before it encounters resistance. And it doesn't just encounter a marginal resistance, it encounters a resistance from the very top, from people we pursue as non-democratic, from people we perceive as, you know, totalitarian. Here a remarkably progressive statement. It could have been made by Corbyn, was slightly more eloquent, but architecture should be like the sunshine from the blue sky and the breeze in spring that will inspire mind, warm hearts, cultivate taste, and clean up undesirable work styles. So, the venom is in the last syllables, I guess. But I read this, and of course, many people and in the press, this quote actually appeared with our CCTV building, so everybody assumed he meant us. But I can assure you that's not the case. He meant everybody else. But reading it, of course, there's an interesting echo here, and I couldn't figure out until I read Khrushchev again, 1954, the famous speech where he cleaned up Stalinist architecture. All this architectural and artistic decorum. No, comrades, this is architectural perversion that leads to the spoiling of materials and unnecessary expenditure of resources. It's an interesting thing, because this used to be an argument against Stalinist architecture. In China, it is largely an argument against modern architecture, which somehow, in a strange way, has come full cycle and apparently triggers some of the same feeling that the kind of ornamented Stalinist architecture triggers. So one wonders, this is constructivism in the 20th century, the Workers' Club, 1928, by Golosov. This is Eleshitsky in the 20th century. This is Eleshitsky in Rotterdam, recently completed. This is Le Corbusier in America, white. This is Rietveld Schroederhaus. This is its equivalent in the United States, House 6. And, of course, don't want to spare ourselves, this is the Barcelona Pavilion, and this is the Groninger bus stop. with a seriously reduced... I mean, you can see the relevance of budget constraints in recent times, with a serious reduction of the marble. Anyway, this is the manifesto of modern architecture, the Maison Domino, the Plan Libre. Meanwhile, this stands for, at the time, for basically the possibilities of reinforced concrete, economic use of materials, freedom of planning, in a way, all the ideals that were to herald an enlightened period, as was the 20th century. This is that whole thing full cycle. This is a realized version of the Plan Domino, which is actually in Greece, where buildings are deliberately not finished because it gives very interesting tax breaks. But that's neither here nor there. What, in a way, the somewhat unfair comparison between these two images meant to illustrate is that the same architecture, which functioned one way in the context of a particular society and ideology, can actually aid and abet purposes which are completely antithetical to its initial ideology. But nevertheless, architects in this day and age which produce this in a very serious manner still think they are promoting an old ideology when actually unwittingly they've become completely complicit into agendas they either don't know or would never endorse if they knew them, or they know them and they endorse them, but I mean any of the three combinations isn't very flattering. If this was vernacular individual architecture in 1914, where in a way the different character of nations was expressed through architecture in a different way, this is the character of that nation actually expressed in this day and age, a kind of a process of homogenization where largely initial building styles have been traded in for something else without the promise that those styles once had. And it is very, very interesting that in a way this transition is mirrored by another very, very similar transition in the political sphere. If this were politics and events in politics at one point, then this is the current state of politics, where there is no difference because simply every nation, dictatorial or democratic, is trying to get the Olympic Games as the sum total of politics. So I want to go back. We assumed the world would look like this after 1991, and in fact, we found the world looking like this. And it's doubtful if it's going to change in a hurry. Because one of the assumptions was that by becoming democratic, you would become rich. That in a way, the blessings of capitalism and the blessings of democracy were part of the same tandem. It is actually increasingly becoming clear that that is not the case. It's specifically the countries which officially still call themselves communist in this day and age that seem to be better at the capitalist game than its original inventors, the liberal democracies of the West. Let's look at this. This is an overview of the sovereign wealth funds of nations. It's a lot of examples. It's the top 10 largest sovereign wealth funds. If you add it all up, you clearly see that in terms of playing the money game, the success is kind of inversely proportional to the degree of democracy, which is worrying, but which is a very serious political reality that I think every politician ought to reckon with. I want to go back to Dubai. Essentially, it's Dubai by the beginning of the century. Oil struck. The country was modernized aggressively in physical terms, even though its ruling system was not modernized. It's the same families that have been presiding over the country for more than a century, which actually currently preside over modernism, which is another very curious contradiction. It had a period of kind of relative enlightenment with Western and mostly actually Asian avant-garde, like Tanga, building in the Middle East, and it had very interestingly planning. This is a very interesting thing. This is the very first urban plan for Dubai, which prepares for the growth. It's made more or less at the time of the first image with the empty road that I showed. It's made by Parsons. It was meant to last 20 years. Then, of course, Dubai grew faster than its planning could keep up with. Ever more frantic planners, rolled up sleeves, frantic sketches. But anyway, somewhere in 2003, halfway through the term of the first structure master plan for the Emirate, actually a new plan had to be drawn. And that plan largely, more or less, traced things which had happened anyway, trying to retroactively make them look deliberate. But even before this plan could be finished, it had already again been overtaken by reality, at which point the whole notion of planning becomes rather shaky. I think it's a mistake to regard a place like Dubai as a city that can be planned. This is, in a way, its composition. A series of theme parks, a series of individual snippers of urban development, which in a way each compete for the same market of expat residents, and in a very interesting way also announcing the next phase of the agnostic. Because if this was the image from Delirious New York, where architecture was agnostic, Dubai, and where urbanism was the only thing, the urban grid, the only thing that kept these things together, Dubai introduces the next phase, where actually the urban plan has become part of the agnostic. The city and city ideology has become as exchangeable as the building. So as a carrier for diversity, also the notion of the urban begins to break down. There's no accurate study of Dubai's current development, not because we're incapable of cancer, but because the time such a study materialized on paper would no longer be valid, as the achievement pace would have exceeded it by folds. This is clearly the case, a vision of the ruler, which means that the only form of planning imaginable for a situation of mutually competing haphazard development would be a form of air traffic control, where real time you would monitor all the developments that happen, in a way trying to ensure that none of them would conflict with each other. Either a form of air traffic control or a form of simulating military maneuvers, as the army does with battleships, in this case large urban developments, which sort of have to be kept at bay from each other so they don't have disastrous encounters. How is that done, and why is that done? I mean, in many ways you could say that this is done because Dubai is not a state. Dubai is something between a corporation and a state. Dubai has a single ruler. Now, contrary to what many may think, and this is certainly not a moral condemnation of any sorts, this man is not elected. Nevertheless, if there were elections, he would win by a 90% majority without a single case of fraud in the whole election. That is sure, because, I mean, and there are people in the West who emphasize now the importance of competence for rulers, mainly in America, but, I mean, this man runs a city-state which is more or less small enough to be run in a particular way. It's not to say that it doesn't have institutions. It's not to say that it doesn't have a government structure. In fact, the government structure looks suspiciously like that of the Netherlands or Britain, but there is a twist. Many of the functions inside the public office, inside this structure, are occupied by certain people. But those same people actually have the private sector. And where in our political ethos, it's of course a conditio sine qua non that you have to relinquish your private business interests for you to assume public office, there's the other way around. Business interests are a prerequisite to assume public office, which means that the whole place is essentially run very successfully on the basis of a conflict of interest. And conflict of interest is everything we try to avoid there. It's the very mechanism that keeps the whole system going. An example, the chairman of the Executive Council is the chairman of Dubai Holdings, very important property developer. Chairman of the Department of Economic Development is chairman of the largest property developer. The port, the guy who runs the port is the same guy that runs Nakheel. It's essentially the same people running the thing on both ends of the spectrum, public and private. So this is the way it works. This is, in a way, this is the real estate sector, for instance. What from the periphery seems a free market landscape with a huge amount of relatively small competing companies is actually something else, because 51% of each of these companies is owned by a big holding. As is these. There are three big holdings. And of course, the ruling family, again, has a 51% stake in each of the holdings, where de facto you have something that looks like free enterprise, looks suspiciously like what we encounter everywhere, but that on closer inspection is a completely controlled, single-owned large entity. So hey, they have the benefit of appearing small when they need to be and acting big when they need to as well. So to some extent, you know, to take the analogy a little bit further, the whole development of this emirate is masterminded from a metaphorical center, from a metaphorical, this is Dr. Strangelove with Dubai in the background, by the way. But that is the basis of its success. And it is very interesting that in a way, something that I describe here and probably would condemn every single aspect of it is nevertheless a system that seems to perform very, very well. I mean, even seems to perform well in certain social aspects. Anyway, there's an interesting crossover here too. I mean, this metaphorical control room, which we once drew in an attempt to describe the principle at work, it actually exists. And it doesn't exist in Dubai, it exists somewhere else. This is a digital town hall, as they call it, in Rio de Janeiro, built by IBM, Centro de Operações of the Prefeitura of Rio, where in an analogy with NASA, the city is planned, monitored, controlled, and governed. The analogy with NASA goes so far that employees are forced to wear strange kind of jumpsuits while looking at the city. Of course, employees wearing a jumpsuit equates the city to outer space, unwittingly, but I don't know to what extent one is aware of that. And they look at Rio. And when they look at Rio, they see that Rio has favelas. They see that Rio is poor. As a matter of fact, and they look at that from behind a computer screen. The question, of course, is what changes? What changes when you can look at the obvious from behind a computer screen? You can quantify it 80 digits behind the comma. I mean, what does big data really politically change? And it's a major question. To what extent monitoring equals governance? IBM is very, very clear about that. I mean, for them, the smart city is on its way in part and parcel to replace government. I'd like to talk about a number of these initiatives. IBM has launched something which they called Smarter Cities. I guess that means that all our cities, as urban planners, were dumb. But we take no offense, because also IBM isn't the only one. There is a million and one companies tech companies, digital companies, which now involve themselves with the city. Anything from Cisco, IBM, Philips, Siemens, etc., etc. And we used to write manifestos about the city. Now, in this day and age, they write manifestos, and they write in a kind of beautiful marketing speak, very, very confident manifestos. Let's look at the three of the largest, Siemens, Cisco, and IBM, and let's look at their claims and their manifestos. This is Cisco. Smart city development is a question of when, not if, a question of how, not what. Why? Because we live in a world experiencing economic turmoil, climate change, aging populations, and rapid urbanization. Another one, IBM. Climate change, rising energy prices. Very big claims. Siemens here, urbanization, population growth, climate change, dwindling resources, and then set off against the potential of IT and urban infrastructure. So we did a little exercise. We, in a way, merged these three manifestos into one and looked at all the things they could cumulatively solve, which is anything from climate change, dwindling aging population, rising energy, economic turmoil, population growth. That is a whole lot of things. I mean, and that is an admirable proposition. And it, to some extent, it reeks of some of the grandiose claims from the age of Corbusier, or from earlier generations of architects, which thought they had found the panacea for all the world's problems. And you know, a century later, we know better. But nevertheless, this is a younger generation of people who look at the city, and this is what they claim to solve. Incidentally, they evoke the apocalypse only to offer redemption. And in doing that, they invoke a very old technique. They largely invoke the technique of the Bible. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. You just replace the Lord by IBM. You've got more or less the same marketing brochure. But it goes on, and it's serious business. The smart city claims to deal with traffic, energy, utilities, healthcare, airports, social services, rail, public safety, education, etc. Smart water, public services. Siemens, again, public administration, financing, security. And the interesting thing is, if you add it all up, what used to be public tasks, what used to be tasks of elected governments, what used to be tasks executed by people we voted for, apparently now are cumulatively taken over by a collection of smart city entrepreneurs. So to say that the erosion of the public sector and the erosion of public accountability is something that happens only outside the West is a huge mistake. There's a video by IBM was filmed in St. Louis, and it's the police, it's St. Louis, and we know the St. Louis metropolitan area from a different type of police action. Ferguson is just next door. And of course we need answers for Michael Brown Jr., the killing of an unarmed teenager, a policeman. So it certainly wasn't a form of stopping it before it happens, but with a slightly different twist. This is the police. This is, I think, what smart police amounts to. That smart technology is not in a desktop of some form of remote monitoring, but is very real and present in the gear of a police that actually increasingly looks like an army. Ferguson, as I said, is in the St. Louis area. Surprise, surprise, the whole judicial state of St. Louis isn't very, very good. It's in fact dire. But this is a challenge that IBM has risen to in a way to combat. Special partnership with the St. Louis metropolitan area to combat crime. And as their first major act, they actually awarded St. Louis an IBM award after they had partnered it, so they essentially awarded themselves an award. St. Louis is interesting. I mean, St. Louis is interesting also for architects because, I mean, I assume that most of you know this image, the demolition of the Pruitt-Igoe housing estate in 1972, heralded by most critics, and one critic in particular, Charles Jenks, as the death of modern architecture, which died in Missouri, St. Louis, July 15, 1972, as a final coup de grace. It's very interesting. Modern architecture died in St. Louis. There used to be this huge public housing estate. Now there is nothing. Also, the city around it has gone. But yes, public housing died. I mean, you in fact have to point at where I was if you go there at present. But it's very interesting that nothing has come in its place. I mean, the city is empty. This estate is gone, but also the city around it has gone. And I think that begs the question if really anything has filled the footsteps of these former ideologies. And we all know an overdose of utopia is changed, but I think what you see here is rather the consequences of an underdose of utopia, which doesn't look any more uplifting. So this was Pruitt Igoe, 1968. This is gone, and of course other critics, Colin Rofer, kind of call out city, not only the death of modern architecture, but also the city of Hilbersheimer, Corbusier, etc. The whole CM effort essentially found its death when actually Pruitt Igoe found its death. So that's the end of utopias like this. And interestingly, the same city that is the burying ground of the modern utopia now seems to be the birthplace of a new utopia in the form of smarter cities. But will they be any more successful? That is, of course, a major question. There's another interesting crossover here. I mean, IBM talks about smarter cities. There is somebody else who simply talks about the fact that cities are smarter by definition. This is Benjamin Barber, who has written a book, If Mayors Ruled the World. Actually, his proposition is that cities are run so much better than nation in the context of failing nation states. It is cities who should rise to the challenge, often linked to smart city initiatives, because they could deal better with interdependence and simply could deal better, better governors in the context of a globalized world. There's, of course, something to be said for this, you know, because urbanization is on the rise. There's gradually more cities, bigger cities, more and more people. More than half of the world's population lives in cities. There are certain cities which are bigger than entire nations. Sao Paulo is bigger than Austria. Mexico City is bigger than Finland. Nevertheless, they're not part of the United Nations or anything. But there is a very interesting flip side to this as well. Because if cities, in a way, outgrow nations, in the world of globalization, corporations outgrow cities. And that is a very weird jump of scale, because, I mean, in terms of political authority, I guess the order we all assume is upside down from the actual size. And that means it's only a matter of time before that system starts to become very, very frictional. Of the 10 largest economies in the world, 37 are corporations. We did a little test. Interestingly, this is a list of the largest countries. This is a list of the largest cities. This is a list of the largest corporations in terms of turnout, in terms of money. And then we simply made a list which was only according to the turnover of money. So then the whole list starts to mix. It's very interesting. You see Walmart being bigger than Norway, BP being bigger than Greece, Cisco being bigger than the whole of Lebanon, Ford being bigger than the whole of Morocco. And actually, you could, I mean, with a bit of imagination, you could actually read the current globalized world as a collection of, you know, corporate territories. And of course, this has an interesting effect. This footlooseness and the size of corporations has an effect on their behavior, where I can think that, you know, corporate growth is probably inversely proportional to corporate loyalty to nations. This is an invented diagram, but I mean, I thank you. I think everyone gets the point. To the point, but look, Amazon faces European tax avoidance investigation. The British don't want to stop Starbucks from dodging taxes. It won't work. And this one's priceless. Eric Schmidt from Google, the defense tech short. It's called capitalism. But let's analyze it like this. If before globalization, before Fukuyama, you could presume a relative degree of corporations to the nation where they were founded or where their headquarters is, after 1991, such is not the case. There is a subtle shift in emphasis. But if we equate corporation to private and nation to the public sphere, the world is the world, a different picture starts to emerge. Because again, you can equate that to the economy and the political. So where there was some form of checks and balances between the economy and the political in this system, you know, as being condemned to each other. In the new system, the political is more or less the ought one out. It is the one standing aside, this ménage à trois, and that's the current situation. And of course, if you make the letters bigger, world economy spells one word, and the political gets minute, that the side effect of the escalation of scale of the economy without an appropriate escalation of scale of the political, or at least the ambitions of the political, runs the risk of, in a way, making the political oblivious, which means that in the last instance, the agnostic age, which started with agnostic architecture, leads to an agnostic political situation with a relative interchangeability of an a la carte situation and interchangeability of those ideologies into irrelevance. A last chapter. So Fukuyama, 1991. We're 25 years later than the book. We celebrated the fall of the Berlin Wall. This wall fell. This wall, I think, will be constructed if the American elections go the wrong way. But anyway, about that, we see the fall of the Berlin Wall, but in a way the re-emergence of a whole load of walls, conflicts of interests in the rest of the world, the system of parallel systems which agree to disagree, largely still exists in a different form. What do we do? I mean, we largely, as architects, get by. We learn from it, try to accumulate wisdom. But I think we should be careful in endorsing certain things. I mean, I always shiver when I read stuff like this. I think it's Foster, so that's okay. China rather than England. In Beijing, they have built a much larger new terminal than Terminal 5, plus a new runway in less than 5 years. I mean, it's heralding the efficiency of China over the supposed inefficiency of Britain. Here we go. This is a collection of interesting quotes. We're in a state of denial while they, the Chinese, are making decisions in the spirit of the Victorians. They have the courage to try it. No, I don't know who this is. What attracts me about China is that there is still a state. There is something that can take initiative on a scale of a nature that almost nobody that we know of today could ever afford or contemplate. Eisenman. The more centralized the power, the less compromises need to be made in architecture. The directions are clearer. Democracy, obviously, is something we don't want to get rid of, but it does create chaos. Look at the author. It means the guy next door can do what he wants, and it creates a collision of thinking. In cities, that means people build whatever they want. I just recently learned that Frank Gehry's work is apparently highly contextual. I never knew. Some of the most amazing places were built because of dictators' architecture. It's always related to power and related to large interests, whether financial or political. And this one, I think, is priceless. I fully endorse it. I think the best thing to have is a benevolent dictator who has taste. It is kind of interesting because there seems to be a consensus. I mean, and maybe more than a consensus just between Pritzker Prize winners, that the world indeed is venturing towards a homogeneous condition. The only thing is that that condition isn't Western liberal democracy. I ultimately think it is something else. And I think the danger maybe that something else is neither red nor blue, but maybe in fact all yellow, all pseudo-democracy. And the question if that can still count on a yes 25 years later. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.